When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi everyone, it's Bud, and welcome to the latest episode of Before the Cheering Started, all about the journey to success and professional fulfillment. There's a beautiful and mysterious quality to Sean Colvin's music. When you hear one of her songs, there's no mistaking it for anyone else's. She calls herself a good copycat, but when she covers someone else's song, like Bruce Springsteen's Tougher Than the Rest or Bob Dylan's You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go, she makes it all her own. When she started writing her own songs after more than a few years in the business, those songs became her calling card. Diamond in the Rough, Sonny Came Home, and Shotgun Down the Avalanche. Songs that hold up beautifully and mysteriously to this day. You're currently on tour with Katie Tunstall. Mm-hmm. You've toured in the past couple of years with one of my favorites, Sarah Jarosz. And I saw a video the other night, which I'd never seen before, from about 10 years ago, of you with a musician named Taylor Swift, who I understand is doing okay. And her, I think it was in Austin, giving you a shout out and performing with you on stage, Sonny Came Home. And I'm
well,
curious.
I performed with her, to be fair.
Okay.
She didn't come to my concert. I was invited to hers. So.
Well, all depends on your perspective.
Well, true. But
those are three examples, and there are many more, of musicians who stand on your shoulders. And I'm curious, when that starts to happen, when you start to hear that, what that feels like.
Oh my gosh, I never really thought of it that way, Bud, to tell you the truth. I really haven't. I don't keep track of who might had sitting on my shoulders. That's an interesting perspective. Although, yeah, Taylor wouldn't have invited me if she hadn't liked the song. So I guess that's true. My perspective is just being in touch with the people who influenced me. You know, I'm not sure who I influenced, but, you know, that's quite an honor to think that I have.
To be clear, and I've talked to Sarah about this, they are very clear on the influence. And I guess maybe as a artist in general, are maybe more in touch with those people who influence them. And so to turn the coin on it from those you influenced who now stand on your shoulders, one of my favorite videos from the last couple of years is you and James Taylor at Austin City Limits singing Close Your Eyes.
Yeah. Oh my
and
God.
There's a second before you sing the song, which is a beautiful version. There's a second of you looking at the crowd, and it kind of encapsulates for all of us, I think, those of us who are amateur musicians and professional too, of, wait a minute, I sat on my couch and I listened to this guy and many others, and now I'm sitting here in front of Austin City Limits about to sing one of his most beautiful songs.
Right. It never stops being a pinch me moment. You know, if you'd have told me, I'll tell you my James Taylor, you know, epiphany awakening when I was 15 years old and I was babysitting next door to our house, and a friend of mine named Jane came over with a 45 and said, you got to hear this. And it was Fire and Rain. So, you know, the rest is history. And I think, it's having your heroes become people that you get to be on stage with, that you get to share that privilege or have that privilege of doing is just one of the, if not the greatest reward of doing what I do, aside from, you know, the creation being the reward itself, you know, the fact that I can do these things. That, and so that's just ridiculous. that I got to do that. And there are several others who I've been able to perform music with and get to know. So yeah, okay, if Sarah feels that way about me, I won't harsh it, you know. I'll take it. That's fantastic. But, again, not just fellow artists, but just fans, I don't think understand that, you know, when they come up to me and say, well, I know you've heard this a million times, but you were the soundtrack to this period of my life, or this song changed my life, or this song got me through this. It's the biggest compliment you can really receive, or I can really receive, because look at the people that changed my life. Look at the music that changed my life. Look at my soundtracks. Healing stuff, you know, like paramount healing touchstones. So if I'm that to someone else, how much better can it get?
It just came up for me the other night. It jogged a memory. I have a daughter now who's 20, and around the years of 3, 4, and 5, I must have sung her and listened to with her your version of "I Don't Want to Live on the Moon" a thousand times. And after she had moved on from it, she had moved on from her, shall we say, Sesame Street phase. I had not. And so we get in the car. I said, "Allie, come on, let's listen to this." And she'd be like, "Daddy, I'm 16 now. I just, you know, really." But one thing I'm always fascinated by in interviewing artists, again, be it musicians or writers, actors, playwrights, the tentacles, you never know where the tentacles are going to extend. And so for us, that particular song, or your version of that song, it takes me right back to a specific memory, and a specific memory connected to for me, family.
Well, exactly. It's just transcendental. I mean, the music and art, the fact that you can develop spiritual connections really with these pieces, and that they do bring you back and anchor you and become part of you. Just art is that, you know. So again, to evoke that feeling or be that for anyone else, I can't really even take it in.
After these many years and this long and wonderful career, I'm always curious, do you know when you're writing when you have a good line?
Yes. Yes, I do. It's a wonderful experience. and it's hard one a lot of times, although many times it just comes out of nowhere, which is the magic of it, if you will. And you can work very hard on a lot of crap, kiss a lot of frogs, as it were, to hit the right note, you know, figuratively speaking. But some of the best lines come just out of my mouth. And I think that connection is just not something you can conjure all the time. And it's really a gift. So I played a new song last night, and KT asked me what the name of the song was, and it's two words from the first line. And I thought about it, and I thought, where did that come from? You know, and it was just one of those lines that fit the music. I had the music first. It says, I made my bed in a spider web. Don't ask me. I found something to do with it, you know, but I'm not sure where it came from. I like to also reference Diamond in the Rough, because that was kind of my breakthrough songwriting song. And John Leventhal had given me some music, and I, for the first time, I didn't write to or to his production. He gave me a produced piece of music. And I sort of had this epiphany, well, look, you're an acoustic guitar player, you know, you're a folk singer, and you are lucky enough to be able to entertain people with just you and your guitar. And that's kind of the root of, you know, your heroes did that. So why don't you issue the production and figure this out on acoustic guitar, you know, like make it work. So I did that. I got the music going on just acoustic, And this line comes out of my mouth. As a little girl, I came down to the water. And I went, oh, my God. You know, I was really appalled. And it was just so twee. I was like, a little girl, really? You're going to go there? And I called, but that's what came out of my mouth. So I called John, and I ran it by him with a little stone in my hand. I had two lines. And I sang it to him. And I swear to God, if he'd have said, I don't get it, I'd have thrown it out. But he said, and I remember exactly, he said, I think you've got something there. Keep going.
God bless him for that.
No kidding. He held great weight for me in terms of writing songs. And if he hadn't have liked it, I don't know what would have happened.
Well, the one that's always struck me through the years is, and maybe analyzing it is kind of like, you know, they say the death of comedy is analyzing why a joke is funny. So we shouldn't really, you know, analyze, oh, this song and so on. But you're riding Shotgun Down the Avalanche to me is, wow. I mean,
well, that's another example.
There is a perfect image.
You know, that came from, I wanted to use interesting words. I was like, you know, let's anchor some songs with Ricochet was came from that too. Like, let's anchor a song with an interesting word, see where it goes. And so that was in my consciousness. And I was walking down the street in New York one day, and I heard this girl say to her mother, "Oh, Mom, don't have an avalanche." And I thought, that's a good word. And then same thing, really. I'm riding Shotgun Down the Avalanche. It just came out of my mouth. And then I figured out what it meant. It doesn't happen all the time, at all. But those are some good examples.
There's a famous story from the Beatles anthology in the mid-90s of McCartney saying about the movement you need is on your shoulder.
Oh, and John wanted him to change it.
No, McCartney. McCartney said, "You know,
good line, yeah."
Yeah, I'll change that. I'll change that. And John Lennon says, "You won't. It's the best line in the song."
It's the best line in the song. Love it. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, your perspective is good.
So at that time, when we're talking about those songs, you're in New York. You had been in Austin. You had been starting out in Illinois, where you'd been living as a teenager. Had you made your peace previous to that? That you would be a musician, but not necessarily write songs, or the notion of writing songs, was it always kind of bubbling in there? And for one reason or another, it didn't come to the fore until you got to New York and were there for a little while.
Yeah, I always wanted to be a songwriter. I was a good copycat. I was an excellent copycat. And I could perform easily, get in front of people. I covered songs well. And, you know, I really made my living, you know, as a young person doing four sets a night covering Fleetwood Mac and so on. And, but I, at the heart of it, all I wanted to do was write songs. And I was just scared. I thought, it's all been said. My heroes set the bar. This is just not what I do. This is just not my strength. Although when I was 15, I wrote a bunch. I wrote a bunch of songs. I was lovelorn, and they're pretty bad. But that period of time ended. And then I realized later, when I kind of got a handle on the whole thing, that I would write snippets of songs, you know, intermittently. And I did pick some of those up when I broke through and found my voice as a songwriter. Like Ricochet is one of them. I started that in the Bay Area, like years before, just little snippets. My punch card and my mirror. I was working at a stained glass store. I had to punch in a card to start working. And I was not sober at that time. So I started that song there, and I know, you know, just didn't think anything of it, and picked it up later. And wrote the choruses and ended it in New York, you know, started in the Bay Area and ended up in the big city. So I was always trying, but it didn't come to fruition until I was, whatever, 28 years old. It didn't start clicking. And I'm so glad it did. It was my dream come true to make that Steady On record and have written or co-written every song on it. Like that was, if I never made another record and I still feel that way to this day, happy as can be, just my dream come true.
During that process of making that album, that wonderful album, is there doubt or is there some notion of, no, I think I got something here?
No, I thought I had something and I was, I don't think I was pompous about it. Right. I always think of Terrence Trent D'Arby. Remember Terrence Trent D'Arby? I love Terrence Trent D'Arby. But I remember it when he did early press, he was on my label too. And he said, can I swear, bud? Can I say
it? Have at it. Have at it.
And he said, I'm a genius, point blank. So I wasn't like that.
Wow. Well, so that's the bar. I'm either above that or below that. That's
pretty confident.
Yeah,
no,
yeah, yeah.
I was comfortable. I didn't care who liked it. That was the blessing of it, to have found my own voice in music and not created some kind of genre or, you know, persona or follow some kind of trend or, you know, I found myself and I really didn't care what people thought of it. Or where it went. It was me and John too.
Yeah. Mr. L is a pretty wonderful producer and amazing musician.
And he doesn't suck, does he?
No. And that's not just because one time I profiled him about 7-8 years ago for a TV station I was working for in New York. And he heard that I played guitar. And so he invited me while on camera to duet with him on some Everly Brothers songs. And I, after we did it, I put down the guitar and I said, you just made sure that this is going to be a great profile of you. So
that's really sweet.
Very sweet of him. Very sweet. Very sweet. So I've read a great quote from you in which you said, the guitar had permanent residence at the foot of my bed growing up.
Yeah.
That's true out in South Dakota, and then when you moved to Illinois, in both spots?
Oh, yeah. My father taught me to play when I was 10. We lived in South Dakota. My father played, and he played the banjo as well. And I'm sure he would have loved to have been a musician. I know it. I know it. He sang in choirs up until he got, you know, Alzheimer's too badly to be able to do anything like that. Although he was always able to remember lyrics. That's something phenomenal about Alzheimer's disease that we learned. Yeah. The talking can go away, but when he heard the music, he could tap to it and often remember lyrics. So it's very strange what the brain can do and the heart can do. But no, he taught me to play the guitar when I was 10. We left South Dakota when I was 11. And moved to Illinois, as you mentioned. I started junior high there. And when I learned to play the guitar, we immediately joined at the hip. And I just practiced and practiced and practiced and hid in my room and couldn't get enough of it. And I was just the move really messed me up. That move we lived in Canada for 2 years in between that, and I really enjoyed where we lived and the friends I made, but we only stayed there for about a year and a half. So when we got to Illinois, I was pretty shaken, and I really hid in my room and clung to that guitar and was pretty miserable for a while with no friends and hated the school. And also had, you know, kind of a form of anxiety disorder and isolated a lot. Would wake up in the middle of the night. I had insomnia. I'd have panic attacks, all that fun stuff. And the guitar was the thing. I mean, that thing was at the foot of my bed because it was the cure for all of it. I remember playing Flowers Never Bend with the Rainfall again and again and again. That was a key song in calming me down.
That's a pretty good one.
It's a
pretty good
one.
So we're about the same age. Is the guitar and after the move, as you mentioned, to Illinois, is there a sense of, well, nobody understands me, but Jackson Browne understands me and Joni Mitchell understands me and all these other musicians, they understand me?
Without question, key element of how I survived, really.
Yeah. And so is there a conversation at home as you're a teenager or getting ready to graduate high school? Is there a definitive conversation. Folks, you know, I love this music and this is what I'm going to do. It's not just a hobby. I'm going out there. I'm going to do it professionally.
No, I think I knew I was going to do it professionally since I was about five. I didn't have very many other skills. This was kind of it. I was one of those teenagers that just, I graduated high school a year early. Because I just wanted out. I just wanted out. I wanted out of the house. And I wanted out of the house. And I packed up when I was 17 years old. And I went to university, but just because I thought that's what you were supposed to do. I had no idea what I was going to study. I didn't want to study music. I knew how to play music. I didn't want to study it. But I went to school nonetheless. My boyfriend was a year older than me, and he started school in the same town. And I started school too and moved to it was Carbondale, Illinois.
And that's Southern Illinois University?
Yeah, Southern Illinois, SIU. Yeah. And I moved to a dorm and eventually moved to an apartment with some friends. And I needed to get out. And no, I made no declaration. I just know, I think they knew I was a runaway train. I think they kind of threw up their hands. quite a while back before I was 17 years old. I was pretty driven.
Your folks were academics, right?
They were academics, but as I said, as my father, taught me to play the guitar, I think his true love was music.
Yeah.
My mother studied some singing in college. She went on to get a law degree. My father had a PhD in psychology. But they were, we would sing in the car on all our trips, four-part harmony, when it was just my brother and I. We were good. It was a good musical family. I was just the one that couldn't shake it.
Did they at all kind of subtly or not so subtly try to influence you into having a plan B in case things didn't work out?
No. They had no control, believe me, and they knew it. They knew it. I didn't care. And when I was 18, it was a university town and a lot of bars. But when I turned 18, I was allowed to play in the bars, obviously. And that was it. That was it. I had a career. I was getting paid. I quit school, and the rest is history, I guess. But I don't know whether they... I do know when I got to New York, this is one quote that I absolutely love, and that was many years later. So I left town when in about 76, moved to Austin, Texas, 75 maybe, and eventually ended up in New York City in 1980, late 1980. And my parents came up to help me move. They brought some things from Illinois up to my East 3rd Street apartment when I finally got an apartment. And they were horrified. I lived on the Hell's Angels block. And, it wasn't a great neighborhood, especially then. It is now. Now it's gentrified all to hell. And they were just really like, couldn't even speak. So my mother called me not long after they had gone back to, and she was rattled, and she said, I just envision you in a pool of blood. Like, thanks for the vote of confidence, Mom. So, they were worried about me.
I envisioned you in a pool of blood, and you have not included that in the song yet?
No. Lying in a pool of blood, I think, was the quote,
Yeah. Those first apartments for all of us are not exactly the lap of luxury. And everyone understands that. Yeah.
It was hideous. But I was happy to get it. I spent at least 3 months living at Buddy's house, Larry's house, Lincoln's house, apartments, I should say, but until I could find a place. It was $220 a month, and no, it was hideous. And I was happy to get it. I moved to in late 80. I got sober in 83. And I was just happy to have a job and camaraderie. I was in a band, Buddy's band, Buddy Miller's band. And New York just felt right. It was easy because it was on a grid. Like, when I lived in the Bay Area briefly, I'm like, what is this spread out situation here? How do I get a handle on this? Where do I get a gig? But I had a job, and I could follow the grid, and I could take the subway. And if I got lost going uptown, I just would look and see where the World Trade Centers were, and I knew that was south.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just seemed to fit me, I stayed there for 13 years.
What sort of jobs did you have along the way to pay the rent while you're building a music career?
Every job, not every job you could imagine. A lot of waitressing. As I mentioned, the stained glass store, more waitressing in New York. I was an administrative assistant at a real estate office when I briefly thought I would quit the business a few years after I got sober, maybe 86 or something, 85. And the worst job I ever had was when I had moved back to Illinois from Texas and was really lost. And I had lost my voice. I had nodes on my vocal cords, and I lost all sense of identity and moved back home. And then I started to feel better. I had taken vocal rest, my voice started to come back. And I knew I had to get out of town. I was living with my parents again. And I got the first job I could get. And this is just, it's almost just too painful to tell. I worked in a vivarium in the basement of one of the university buildings. Now, a vivarium is where they house animals that they do experiments on. And my job was to basically two jobs, clean up guinea pig shit and, scrape the cages and transfer the rats from their Tupperware sawdust cages, I think every other day, not cages, their Tupperware bins, into a clean Tupperware bin. That was my job. And so I learned to pick up rats by the base of the tail. If you picked them up by the end of their tail, they'd whip around and bite you. And that was my job in a basement with no windows. And I made enough money to get out of Carbondale.
Wow. Yeah. I got to say, I've been interviewing people for about 40 years. And first time I've heard the word vivarium. So, under the heading,
I'm proud of that.
And, my worst job was I did ski reports from a bathroom in a New York apartment. But I got to say now, which I thought was a bad job, although it led to something good. But I got to say now, I didn't have to deal with wildlife. So I'm looking at that in a whole new perspective now.
Yeah, I had some rodent education, I'll tell you. But it got me out of there.
More than a few years later, once you come to New York and you do the first album, and then all of a sudden you're on a tour and you're doing interviews and then you're on The Tonight Show. And I'm curious, how does one prepare for something like that only a couple of years after you were considering leaving the business and getting into the glamorous world of real estate?
That was a brief...
A brief chapter.
It was a very brief chapter. It took for a year. I still did one gig a week at the Cottonwood Cafe on Bank Street. Hmm. I did do that. And then I just had this epiphany. It's like, but you're good at this. You're good at it. And you're good at playing solo acoustic guitar and a voice. And I think you got something here. So why don't you give it another go? But you got to write personal songs. And that's what brought me back to music. Kind of turned a corner there. But I think, the interviews, that was a whole new thing. But being on The Tonight Show, things like that. And touring was a new thing too. Although I'd paid my dues with that. I would travel up to Boston and down to D.C. and, Eastern Seaboard a lot to do gigs once I started writing songs. But you kind of, if you're making if you're singing at your parents' parties when you're 14 and then you start playing the bars at 18 and you're playing everybody's parties before then, getting together with your pals and living for music and playing, you've kind of got some groundwork under you. It certainly didn't intimidate me at all to have to go into radio stations and play a song for the radio people, to do shows where nobody came across the country and abroad, because that's what you did to build a following once you made a record. That's how they did it in those days. You went on a promo tour, and it was do press, do radio all day, then go do a gig at a hole in the wall and see who comes out, and then move on. So it was hard work, but I knew how to play and sing, and it was all right. It was all right, and it worked. It was a good paradigm. You know what I'm saying? It was a good model.
Yeah.
That way of building a career doesn't really exist as much anymore.
It's a different world.
Yes, it is.
At one moment, you're sitting on your bed, be it in South Dakota or Illinois, growing up, and you're listening to Judy Collins.
Mm.
And then you snap your fingers and you're on stage duetting with Judy Collins on her song, Since You've Asked.
Yeah. Judy Collins was one of the first. My parents introduced me to Judy Collins. And I remember going to see her at the Edwardsville campus of SIU near St. Louis, amphitheater in the summer. And we were on the lawn. This was like one of the first concerts I ever went to. And my parents took me and a friend. And there were a lot of people smoking weed on the lawn. And my dad would kind of stand up and take these deep breaths. That was the kind of guy he was. I just loved it. But yeah, no, Judy was huge for me. Really one of the first. And learned tons of her songs. Whales and Nightingales, my favorite record that she did. But yeah, we did that at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I believe, or else Museum of Natural History. I can't remember which. It was quite a thing, that taping, and all those years later. And it was such an honor. And I've listened back to that recording and that, and looked at that video many times. And I am just so proud of how well I blended with her. And it makes perfect sense to me. You know, I mean, she's in my DNA. Judy doesn't get enough credit for being the songwriter that she is and the piano player that she is. It is one of the great songs. It's fun, you know, Since You've Asked, incredible.
She told me once, I've interviewed her a few times, more than a few times, and she's told me that, well, so Leonard Cohen was her person who got her to start writing songs. You know, how come you're not writing songs? And the first one she sits down to write is Since You've Asked, and it takes
about 45
minutes. And she's like, what's the big deal? I mean, I just, you know, polished off that in 45 minutes. And then she said,
I didn't know that. Good God.
That's how they get you, you know, in terms of songwriting. That's how they get you. You do one and it comes across and it's a great song. And then all of a sudden the torture or the pain comes in.
Yeah. There's no better feeling than finishing a song. I swear, you know, and I love the Bob Dylan quote. What's your favorite song you've ever written? Which is such a rough question. It's like, no, don't do that to me. And he said, my next one.
Yeah.
And that's the way to look at it.
Well, I've been blessed to do a lot of, you know, interview a lot of very compelling and intriguing, and today's a good example of that, people. And people said to me, oh, what's been your favorite? And I said, the next one. Because what are you going to, you know, how are you going to answer that question? In that moment, and I think it was at the museum in New York doing Since You've Asked, or in other moments, do you have enough? And I realize you're still busy and you're out there touring and making music. Are there moments where you're able to step back even for a little bit and say, I had this idea years ago in places far from here and it worked?
You mean in terms of having a career?
Career, writing, all of it.
You know, I was coming in from Weehawken the other day to the city. And the bus had to park in Jersey. That's a long story. So KT and I took the bus or took a car into the city and stayed there. And the driver, I was staying on the east side of Manhattan, Lower East Side. And the driver, for some reason, I mean, you always go down Houston. Every driver that I've just taken me to that particular hotel goes down Houston. And this guy went down Bleecker Street. I don't know why. And it was epiphanal, really. I I watched Bleecker Street. I haven't felt this way in a long time. And I mean, I spent 10 years paying my dues on Bleecker Street. Like, that was a lifetime ago. And that was a lot of years. And I had such affection. I even became weepy. It was slightly sad. Just that person who, it was sad, but it, I don't know why. But that person who worked, so, you know, it was reminiscing. It was longing. It was a real appreciation. I guess sadness because it's gone. It was a precious, precious time, and that moment gave me perspective on the miracle that it all worked out, but also the perspective that I worked hard for it. Mm-hmm. And those were precious days and obviously very formative. New York was a very important place for me and, you know, a very, very, very important place for me. And I developed a lot as an artist and many, many great things happened. So I forgot what your question was, but that was my answer.
That's okay. Whatever the question was, it was a beautiful answer.
All right.
We've referenced a lot of musicians during the conversation. And as we say here in New York, you ain't exactly chop liver. So
it's a good saying. Thank you, bud.
Thank you for a lifetime of great music.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Shawn Colvin. She's out on tour with Katie Tunstall. Shawn's 2013 memoir is entitled Diamond in the Rough. And you can get more information at seancolvinmusic.com. Before the Cheering Started is a production of June 14th Productions. This episode was created and written by me. Guitar playing, that's me as well. No extra charge. I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is Before the Cheering Started. Thanks for joining us on the journey.